Okay, so we have the privilege to learn together the third Aliyah of Parshas Miketz, this week's Parsha, which continues the story of, if you remember where we left off last year, basically in the middle of a sentence, essentially, that this Aliyah picks up from the end of Sheni of last year, well, Sheni of every year, but we talked about Sheni last year, where Paro is very impressed by Yosef. Yosef has revealed the content of the dreams, and the pasuk says, "Vayomer Paro el Yosef, Achrei Hodia Elokim Oscha Es Kol Zos, Ein Navon V'Chacham Kamocha." Now, the fact that Paro was so impressed is not something to be taken lightly. That's something that's very significant, and this is something we talked about a little bit last year. In the Sefer Psalm Derech, Reb Shimcha Zissel Broid has an essay about this, about the fact that you see that Paro, as he puts it, was not a simple person. He was not an ish pashut. And that the fact that he had such appreciation for Chachma, the fact that he recognized that there was somebody who was so wise, who Soloveitchik understood that the intent of Navon v'Chacham, the combination of those terms, we find them used in different ways, in different places, the Torah, Chachma, and Bina, and Das. Bina sometimes means the ability to understand one thing from another, and Chachma means, say, factual wisdom. But here he understands it that the two abilities represent, on the one hand, the fact that he knows what to do, he has the imagination, and he's also able to figure out how to implement it. And therefore he was very impressed by that. And in addition, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him this knowledge, the fact that this was something that came out of his spiritual wisdom, was something Paro picked up on also. Yosef Fidushinsky comments that usually people who are smart, so they make sure that everyone knows it. And here, Yosef clearly has this tremendous wisdom, and yet he's able to go years before anybody picked it up, before anybody was aware, so he kept it concealed. It was such an impressive thing, Paro takes note of that. So whatever it is, the fact is that Paro clearly has a sensitivity for such wisdom and appreciation for it. And that's not a small matter. We spoke about 2 years ago about the fact that the Parsha emphasizes in certain ways, we won't go into the details now, about the ability to recognize greatness in the sense of Kvod HaMalchus. And we spoke about that in our regular share a few weeks ago. We mentioned that connection as well, a few days ago rather. And that Chanukah is very much about that as well, the ability to recognize the Nes and to recognize greatness in the world and to respond appropriately. So the fact that Paro has this awareness is not a small thing, and here he is ready to elevate a slave boy into his highest position of authority. That was simply not done in Mitzrayim, and to be willing to defy all of those cultural expectations and to figure out how to do so in an effective manner, that's something that is very impressive about Paro. And some of the Rishonim understand Bali Atosus in their commentary to Shmos and Perek Vav and Pasuk Ches, understand that this Paro was indeed the same Paro who would later be involved in the Shibud. And that's a powerful thought. We know the two days in Rashi about the Vayakam Alachadash and Shola Yodas Yosef. Did it mean that he was a new Paro who Taka did not know Yosef, or was he the old Paro who made himself as if he did not know Yosef? And there is a medrash that these Rishonim quote that this is the same Paro, and that ultimately, that initially Paro was resistant to taking on the Jews in any negative way, and the people rioted and they pressured him to, and they ended up deposing him. For 3 months he was taken off of the throne. And then by the time he was returned, apparently he was a changed man. That experience had such an impact on him. At that point, his attitude had completely changed. But before that, he had been somebody who had displayed tremendous appreciation for Chachma and spiritual sensitivity. And that's not something to be taken lightly, and it's not something to take for granted, because we see that even somebody who has those abilities, even if it was the same Paro, so under the political pressure that he ultimately encountered, he found it very difficult to maintain. And that's a tragedy, a personal tragedy for Paro, or perhaps a national tragedy for the Jewish people and for the Egyptians, but it tells us something both about the value of this type of spiritual awareness and also about the fragility of this type of awareness and being able to remain connected to it. And again, this is a theme that's very much relevant to everything that we focus on at Hanukkah time. So here, Paro makes these appointments, makes us these plural appointments of Yosef, because it seems to be that there are a number of different things going on. That the Pasuk says, Pasuk Mem, says, Ata tiel beisi, v'al picha yisha kol ami, rak ha-kisei egdal mimeka. And then the next Pasuk says, V'yomar paro Yosef, re'ei nasati yoscha al kol eretz Mitzrayim. So there's Nayim Lutara, Rabbi Zalman Saratskin understands that there are basically three separate appointments here. That on the one hand, that he's given the financial ministry, essentially, and that's what the Pasuk means, Tatiel Beisi, you will be in charge of all of my accounts. That he's given legislative authority, that's Pasuk Membeis, the next Pasuk after that, Vayasar Paro es Tabato, he gives him the ring. He gives him the authority to make laws and to make rules, because he's not going to be able to effectively implement his economic vision unless he can impose restrictions and control on the people. So that's also a part of it. And then he's also essentially made the Minister of Defense, he says, because now you have to worry that people are going to revolt, especially if he's going to be the slave boy who's suddenly elevated to a position of influence and a position of control, and he's going to be telling people what they have to do, it's not going to go over so smoothly. So later on, in Pasuk Memdalid, the Pasuk says, "Ubiladech al yorim ishes yado," no one's going to be able to raise his hand up against you. In other words, you're going to be in control of things like that. You're going to be in charge of defense as well. And that's going to be a powerful position. That's going to be a position where you can assert defense and control against people who will rebel against you. So to go back for a second to this Pasuk, where he starts to describe all this in Pasuk Mem, so Atat Tiel Beisi V'Alpicha Yishak Kol Ami, Rak HaKisei Agdal Mimeka. So it's just interesting, just linguistically, what does that mean, Alpicha Yishak Kol Ami? So Rashi translates it to mean that it comes from sustenance. That everyone will be supported, everyone will be sustained, Yisparnes, as Rashi, based on what you will do. There are other interpretations. The Maritz Dushinsky explains, based on a Tosfos and Gittin, Tosfos and Gittin on Daf Tesem at Aleph, where it interprets the Pasuk, in Pasuk and Sefer Mishle, Kishva Sayim Yishak, Meshuv Dvarim Nochachim, that somebody who says true answers, so Svasayim Yishak, what does that mean? So Tosfos explains it over there to mean that their lips will touch each other, basically they'll be quiet, people won't have anything to say against you, people will be so awed by the fact that you're saying things that are true, they won't have any response. And so too, that's the suggestion here, that you shouldn't be afraid that people aren't going to listen to you, people are going to be very impressed, they're not going to be able to object. And then when he says, Rak HaKisei Egdal Mimeka, so how do you translate that? So it sounds like on a Pashut level it means that you will be second in command, that only the Kisei of the king is going to be on top of you. But the Sfas Emes has a different interpretation, and he says that it means that the Kisei, the throne, will become greater Mimeka because of you. That because you're going to bring such glory to this nation, so the throne will have greater influence and will become a more powerful presence. And so too, that's how we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God's throne becomes greater, so to speak, kaviyachol in the world, because the Jews are more impressive, because they are greater people. And Rav Schwab has a very similar idea when he notes it's essentially an explicit medrash. It's very interesting if you think about it. It is a medrash very well known because we talk about it Parshas Kedoshim time. There's a few famous drushes on it. There are Chaim Shmulevitz and Shimon Shkap and others have commented on the draw on the medrash, which says that you v'yisam rak l'mayla, says the pasuk, that you shall be high, you shall be elevated. So says the medrash, yachol kamoni, you might think that you could be as high as God.
Says the Pasuk, no, rak, it's a limitation, you can't be as high as God. And then what about the Pasuk, kadoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani, you should be holy for I am holy. So you might think, okay, yachol kamoni, you might think I could be as holy as God. Says the Pasuk, no, ki kadosh ani, I am the holiest, my holiness is greater than yours. Okay, so the Medrash actually finds both of these ideas to have parallel in these psukim that we're reading here. That v'hisem rak lamayla, that you can't be that high as God. That's what Paro says. Rak hakisei agdal mimeka, that only I shall be higher than you. In other words, the word rak is coming here to say that there will be one on top of you. And so too, when God says ki kadosh ani, I maintain the status of the holiness of the holiest. So too, Paro asserts himself and says ani Paro. Says, I am Paro. In other words, you'll be very powerful, but I am still more powerful than you. So the notion of the Medrash, specifically understanding these psukim in the context of Paro, it all comes together, as Rishwab explains, that the idea that God's holiness and God's elevation will always be at the top is on the one hand true, but at the same time, that comes in the context of commanding us to be high and commanding us to be holy, and that the holier we are and the more elevated we are, then the God who is above us finds his honor increased through that. So Paro was very happy. If he had just been a nation of these Shlepper Chartumim, he would not have really been such an impressive king. But now that he has Yosef under him, and he will still be over Yosef, so that's going to be quite an impressive regime. And he's happy to have Yosef on board, and we're supposed to understand, as the Medrash uses these psukim to build upon, that Lahavdil, our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, has a lot of similarity to that. So then the Pasuk, to skip now after all that discussion, so after that we find that Paro basically promotes him, and we're told of Ayikav, Ayakevo, Somer, Kevas, Amishnah, Sherlo, Vikru, Lefon of Avreich, when Asono saw Kalaret Mitzrayim. He gives him this name, first Avreich. And then, hold on, I pushed the wrong button, I lost my magic Chumash. It's a disadvantage not having an actual physical Chumash. Sorry, it took a second to find it again. So then we're told that he's... One of the fun things sometimes about reading certain sections of Tanakh is when you find a lot of Sfarim names that are there. So here in this Aliyah, we have a few. We have the Merkevus HaMishnah, commentary on the Rambam. So that's here in Pasuk Mem Gimel. And then in Pasuk Mem Hei, so it says, Vayikra Paro Shem Yosef Tzafnas Paneh, right? The Ragachavar is named after this. It's an ironic name a little bit, because the name really means the revealer of secrets. And the Ragachavar, his name was Yosef, but his Sefer does reveal secrets if you know how to read it, but it's one of the most challenging Sfarim written certainly in the past 100 years. It's a very, very sparsely worded Sefer. You need a lot of footnotes that are written by others and a lot of explication to try to figure out what he's talking about. But okay, so he's called the Tzafnas Paneach. And it says, Vayitein lo asos nas bas potifera kohen on liisha v'yitzei Yosef al eretz Mitzrayim. So he gives him asnas to marry. So what's pshat? How come he's involved in shiduchim all of a sudden? Why does Paro have to marry him off?
Are you just taking on like a father role because Yosef doesn't have one here?
So he's going to take on the responsibility of Chayev al
Lisa. No, it's like he changes his name. He gives him a daughter. He gives him a woman. Just like that's something a father.
Yeah, that's an interesting suggestion. That could be. In the Sefer Znayim Mutar, he has a couple of other possibilities, where he suggests it's a reasonable one also, but he suggests that, first of all, maybe he's got to worry that what's Potiphar going to do? Potiphar maybe still has some grievances against Yosef, some alleged grievances, but if he's his son-in-law, he's going to have to be proud of him, so that will defuse Potiphar from trying to speak badly about him. And then a related point also to show, it would be a public statement that even the family doesn't think that Yosef was actually guilty of anything with Eshes Potiphar, and the Gemara says in Yevamos, that if somebody is under suspicion of having an inappropriate relationship with a woman, he shouldn't marry her daughter. So we see apparently there was no concern about that here. And, no one really thinks anything about him in that sense. And also, again, if we're worried that he's not going to have influence, people aren't going to take him seriously because he's an outsider and he's the slave boy. So now he has yichus, and now he's married to the daughter of Potiphar. So that's going to help Paro's agenda that he should be taken more seriously. So it's in his interest in that sense. There is an idea in Chazal that to say Bas Potiphara, that the wife of Potiphar really had some type of l'shem shamayim intent when she tried to seduce Yosef, that she wanted to have children from Yosef, who was a holy person. So in the Sefer Znayim Mutar, he quotes his son, Rabbi Eliezer Sorotzkin, who he associates with the Cleveland yeshivas, I guess. Two of his sons were associated with the Tel Zeshiva in Cleveland. But as he quotes his son as asking that, so it's interesting. So here, you sometimes find people have good intentions, and they do things that would otherwise not seem so great, and sometimes they're considered heroic, and sometimes they're not considered heroic. Like we read last week about Tamar, so Tamar had good intentions, so she did what she did, tricking Yehuda into having a relationship with her, and we see Tamar as a heroic figure. And here, apparently, Ishus Potiphar also had some kind of intent along those lines, and she's seen as the villain. So he says an important yisod. He says everyone always claims to have good intentions. Everyone always says they do things for good reasons. But the question is, how do you know who really does and who really doesn't? So you see what happens when they hit a bump, when they hit some type of impediment, how do they react? So if they're claiming to act on behalf of God, and there's some kind of sign from God that it's not working, so then you take it in stride. You take it in that type of spirit. So here, Tamar, it looks like she's about to be executed. It looks like she's about to be burned. But still, she feels she can't expose Yehuda because it'll be Habanas Pnei Chaver Barabim, and it'll be embarrassing him. Okay, so that she'll accept her fate. If that's what God wants, so fine, she's ready to accept that. She's not going to embarrass Yehuda in order to continue with her plan. While Ashes Potiphar, when she finds that her plan doesn't work, so she acts terribly, and she decides to frame Yosef, and clearly goes in an opposite direction. So that's what reveals that whatever claim she may have, that her intent was L'shem Shamayim, we see that that's clearly not where it was actually going. And that undermines everything that she claims to be representing. It's also interesting that there is a Targum Yonason and others who maintain that this daughter was actually adopted. That this was not the biological daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Potiphar, but was actually who? Was actually the daughter of Dina from the episode with Shechem, that she had become pregnant at that time, and the child was sent away and was raised. The Medrash has more details about how exactly this happened, but the child was raised by the Potiphars. So that's a fascinating idea. There is a discussion in Poskim, especially since the Pasuk identifies her as the daughter of Potiphar, or Potiphara, so in Hilchas Gittin, so can you use a father's name if the father is an adoptive father? Is that an issue or not? It comes up also, there's a Ramban in Parshas Pinchas who goes into this, because he claims over there that there are sources in Rishonim that Sarach Bas Asher, the famous Sarach, was actually not Bas Asher. She was the daughter of another man who had previously been married to Asher's wife. So she was adopted by Asher. So again, the question comes up, if the Torah is comfortable with that kind of identification, so then how does that affect Hilchos Gittin and the like? That's a whole discussion. I saw somewhere recently, I don't remember where I saw it, I think on the internet somewhere, that somebody told a joke, a Barchan, somebody, one of these comedians at weddings, who told a joke to Reb Chaim Kanievsky, that he said the Kasha had come up. I think Chaim Kanievsky was quoted as being the one listening to the story. I don't remember where I saw it. But that he said, you could ask a question. So in Yosef's dream last week, so he has 11 people bowing down to him, 11 siblings bowing down to him. So the question is, or 11, 10 siblings plus the father. So that was before Binyamin. So the question is, so there's still one missing. Because what about Dina? How come Dina wasn't bowing down to him? So this jokester said, because we have this idea in Chazal that apparently Dina ends up being Yosef's mother-in-law. And nobody in their wildest dreams would even imagine that the mother-in-law ever ends up bowing down to you. That's completely out of the realm of even a fantasy dream. Okay, that's probably not Pashup Shap. But in any event, so that's an attitude that you have in Chazal. So then or outside of Chazal. So then the Pesukim go on to tell us about Yosef's plan.
says Vatas Aretz Shevishne Hasava Likmatzim. So he gathered up the handfuls, he created otros, and he collected all the food. Okay, the Pesukim continue telling us about that. And then towards the end of the Aliyah, so we have Li Yosef Yulad Shnei Vanim, Beterem Tavosh Nas Harav, Asher Yoldalo Asnas, Baspot Tifera, Kohen On. Yosef has two sons. So the Torah emphasizes here, Beterem Tavosh Nas Harav, that this is before the famine came. So the Gemara says in Tainus and Afir Aleph that you see from here that Asur Lo Liadam L'Shamish Mitaso B'Shnas Ravon. That the Torah is emphasizing this happened before the famine, because it's not right for a person to have relations and to have children as a consequence during the time of a famine. And it's a whole discussion what exactly that means, what's the scope of that. Tosfos over there asks that Yocheved, the daughter of Levi, was born at that time, was born during the time of the famine. That seemed to be okay, so why is there a problem for Yosef? And Tosfos suggests that maybe it's really Amidas Chasidus, at least at that point, that Yosef was taking upon himself. And that's an interesting discussion of itself. Yosef Engel, we mentioned earlier in the week, we mentioned this week that Rav Yosef Engel has a Sefer Beis HaOtzer. He has an encyclopedia of Lumdas. So we only have the first two volumes, Aleph and Beis. So in the first volume, he talks about the language of Aser. We normally assume if the Gemara says Aser, Aser means Aser. It means it's prohibited. Except there is a possibility, he discusses, others don't really accept this possibility as much, that sometimes the Gemara will use the word Aser, it doesn't really mean Aser. It means it's Amidas Chasidus, it means it's a good idea not to, but not necessarily that it's actually prohibited. One of the points to discuss is there, it's a pretty important one, is the Gemara in Brachas and Daf Lamed Aleph, where the Gemara says, Aser lo li adam lamalei schok piv ba'olam hazeh, that it's not right for a person to fill his mouth with laughter in this world. So does that mean it's an actual prohibition? It's literally Aser. So as a whole, there's a lot to discuss about that specific concept, what exactly it means, when does it apply, what does it refer to, is it a prohibition, is it Amidas Chasidus? But as he points out, that the Gemara says that Reish Lakish was praised for doing this, so that Reish Lakish, you know, did this as a personal practice. So if the Gemara also says Aser, so then why is he being singled out for just keeping the halacha in a straight sense? So apparently it's Amidas Chasidus, and it's not necessarily a straight Iser. So it could be the Gemara could use the word Aser, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually prohibited. So some suggest that's the meaning here, and others disagree. And some of the Rishonim who also asked this question, the Balei HaTosfos elsewhere, in the commentary in Chumash, so they suggest that maybe it's a difference here in terms of who fulfilled Puravu. The Gemara in Tainus already says that if someone doesn't have children yet, then it is permissible. So maybe Levi didn't have daughters, so he was allowed to keep having children. They point out that Yosef didn't have daughters either. The Beis Yosef asked this question, what's the difference between Yosef and Levi as far as having daughters? So some leave that as an open question, or answer it different ways, and there are some who suggest that the commentary of Balei HaTosfos and Chumash, they suggest that the difference between Yosef and Levi is they had a machlokus between themselves along the lines of the machlokus between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, that we possibly like Beis Hillel, that Puruvu means to have a boy and a girl, and maybe Yosef paskin like Beis Shammai, that it's two boys. So Yosef had two boys, and Levi had a boy and a girl, so he followed Beis Hillel, that's Puruvu, Levi followed, and Yosef followed Beis Shammai. Okay, could be. But in any event, there is some significant discussion about this whole concept. So you have to figure out what exactly is it about. One might think, just on the basis of the words, that it's about the notion that having children at that time would make the famine worse, would have a greater problem in terms of sustaining more people. In the Tshuvas Mil Tzedakah, he suggests that it's because the children won't be healthy being born into such a context. But Rashi seems to understand it as being a function of being a part of the tzar that's going on in the world. But if the world is a bitzar, or the Jewish people are bitzar, so it's not right to be indulging oneself like that. So along those lines, the Torah Tamima suggests that that's the difference between Yosef and Levi, that this whole concept only applies to someone who is insulated from the tzar.
that if there's a famine going on and a person happens to somehow be protected from it, so then he should not be indulging himself that way. So Yosef, who would be protected in his position from the famine, so maybe he had a responsibility to be mishtatef from the tzar of the people by taking on such a practice. And Levi, who was together with the people, he didn't necessarily have such a consideration. It's an interesting idea. So there's a lot of discussion about this. It's somewhat of a tricky concept. So then the Pasuk goes on to tell us that he named his two sons. He has sons Ephraim and Manasseh. There is an idea some of the Sfarim have that they were actually twins, that could explain maybe why you have the singular lashon here, Yulad Shnei Vanim. But in any event, whether they were twins or not, so he has a Bechor, and he has a second son. And the Pasuk tells us how the names go. Vayikra Yosef Hashem HaBechor Menashe. Why is he called Menashe? Ki Nashani Elokim Es Kol Amali V'Es Kol Beis Avi. That he has made me forget. That's what we discussed a few weeks ago in terms of the possible translation of the word Gid HaNashe. That maybe it comes from Rashi there, quotes this Pasuk. And we mentioned the whole discussion that maybe it means to forget, that it has something to do with forgetfulness. And the son Ephraim is V'Hashem Hasheni Kar Ephraim Ki Ephrani Elokim Be'aretz Ani. God has allowed me to be fruitful, to have children, even in this land of affliction. So that name is not so surprising. The Bechor's name is a little more surprising. The whole idea that he names his Bechor after the notion of forgetting Beis Avi, it's very hard to understand. What exactly does that mean? That he's happy about forgetting Beis Avi. Isn't it the whole milo that he maintains his connection to his father's household, that he maintains his connection to his father's values? And we know that Chazal tell us the only reason he was able to stand strong when Eshes Potiphar tried to seduce him is because he saw his father's image in his mind. That was a line that Soloveitchik felt was so influential. He put that as the opening quote for the book Halachic Man. So that notion that he maintained his connection clearly is one of the key values of Yosef. So here to say, I'm happy that I forgot everything, what exactly does that mean? So Rav Schwab has a comment where he suggests that it's in an emotional sense, that he felt that if he really remembered emotionally everything about what it was like to be home, he'd have a very hard time functioning. The pain would be so much greater, his being isolated and being in slavery. So the fact that he's able to disconnect from that on some emotional level, that was a rachmanis that he had to give great, he had to express gratitude for. There's another approach as well, which Schwab talks about, and Simchas Lebroi talks about, and I say for some Derech also, where he notes there is a Gemara in Bav Metzia, where the Gemara tells the story of Rav Zeira, that Rav Zeira, when he came to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel, so he fasted many times that he should forget all his Torah from Bavel before beginning to learn in Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara talks about different drachim that they had, that in Bavel they were called chovlim, they used to fight each other in learning, and in Eretz Yisrael everything was more pleasant, everybody got along, it was a different atmosphere, and he was starting to learn in Eretz Yisrael. He prayed that he had to forget everything that he had learned in Bavel so that he could properly learn what was going on in Eretz Yisrael. So Sam Darach talks about that as a reflection of the fact that different contexts require different tools. And if you're in a different setting, sometimes you have to be able to adapt and be ready to do everything differently than you had done before. Otherwise, you're not going to succeed. So here, Yosef realized that in order to be able to function and to maintain his standards in Mitzrayim, he's going to have to operate in a completely different way. And that's what that required. And he was grateful for the ability to do so. And Rav Schwab adds a little spin of drush to this by suggesting also, specifically in terms of the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel that the Gemara highlights, that you have different types of people who interact with others. You have sometimes people will be in an argument with others and they can't even listen to the other person's position. They're so set in their ways, it doesn't really enter into their consciousness at all, and they just end up fighting to defend their position or fighting off the other position. And then you have others who can interact, and they can really listen to what the other person says, and they can really take it in. And even if they still disagree, but they'll disagree from a much stronger perspective because they've considered all the alternatives. They've had somebody really present the other side. So in Eretz Yisrael, they would disagree with each other as well, but the disagreement reflected a more genuine ability to listen to what the other side was saying, and therefore ultimately a greater truth. Therefore ultimately it was a more solid position, even if it ended up being the same position that they started with. So he thought that maybe Yosef and his brothers had a similar type of situation that in their earlier years. So Yosef was Motzi Diba, he spoke Lashon Hara about his brothers, L'shem Shemayim, he believed. And they sold him into slavery, they believed L'shem Shemayim. Each one believed their position was L'shem Shemayim, but clearly each one was not seeing how the other one had any validity. And now, in their later years, and as the situation will ultimately end up, so Yosef began to feel that maybe they could see each other's positions and that they could make a break from that earlier history. And perhaps that's a little bit al pidar chadrush, what the connection is getting at. Okay, so that's in terms of the Aliyah. We'll stop there. But I just want to maybe add two words, sort of Lanyana Diyoma in different ways. So first of all, just I want to come back to last week's parsha for a minute, to say something that's relevant to today. So remember last week we spoke about the pasuk v'habor reik ein bo mayim, and about how that appears in our Gemara on Daf Chav Beis Mid Aleph and Masechet Shabbos in the context of the Chanukah sugyas. And we mentioned last week that there were a lot of pulpulim that the different Svarim had, that you could spend many hours reading all kinds of very elaborate suggestions as to how that passage has anything to do with Chanukah and why it appears in our Gemara in the middle of the Chanukah sugyas. So that's true, and I'm not going to revisit that, except just to mention one idea from the Chassam Sofer. And the Chassam Sofer has a pilpul also to explain the connection, which I'm not going to focus on that part of it because that's a little bit of a distraction. But there is one idea from the Chassam Sofer that I wanted to share specifically today. So I'm just going to mention the essential kernel without necessarily going into his whole discussion. You can look it up. It's in his commentary in Chumash. You can look up exactly how he connects that to the flow of the Gemara. But he makes the following point, that our Gemara says that Tabor Reik Ein Bo Mayim, what does that mean? It wasn't really empty fully, it was empty a little bit, but there were scorpions and snakes that went in and out. So the truth is, there's another attitude in Chazal. Elsewhere, Chazal suggests that Habor Reik Ein Bo Mayim means Nisrokna Mimayim Shel Torah, that setting, that atmosphere where the bor was, had become empty of the water of Torah, Ein Mayim El Torah, that the discussion among the brothers was lacking any chachma, was lacking the wisdom of Torah. What's that a reference to, and why is that a conflicting interpretation of the pasuk? So as the Chassam Sofer explains, it's a reference to what Yehuda says. He says, Ma betza, it's not going to profit us anything if we kill our brother. Let's not do that. We might as well just sell him into slavery. So apparently Yehuda is saying that he'll be better off if we sell him into slavery. We don't have to actually kill him. Killing him apparently is worse. The problem is, it's not clear that that's really the Torah's attitude, because the Gemara Maseches Bava Basra seems to say that shevi, that imprisonment, could be worse than death. So that's why this attitude in Chazal is that Yehuda is devoid of the chacham of the Torah when he says, oh, what's the point in killing him? We can just sell him into slavery. When Chazal say it's actually worse to be in slavery than to be dead. So our Gemara doesn't seem to accept that drasha and has an alternative drasha. Habor Reikem Bomayim means snakes and scorpions. And perhaps it disagrees with that whole premise. And indeed, we mentioned yesterday, when we were talking about Hallel, that the possibility of Hallel being Doraisa is based on a Kal Vachomer, that if the Jews said Shira when they were freed from slavery in Mitzrayim, so all the more so we should say Shira if we're freed from a threat of death, because Ma Mishibud L'Geula Omrim Shira Mimisa L'Chaim Lo Kol Shekein, that if we say Shira on being freed from slavery, so all the more so on being saved from death. Which makes it sound like Yehuda's position, that death is worse than slavery. So we seem to have this theory here. Which one is right? Is it that death is worse than slavery, or is it that slavery is worse than death? So the Chassam Sofer suggests that Yehuda and that Kal Vachomer about Yetzias Mitzrayim, that's all before Matan Torah. Before Matan Torah, okay, so death is the worst thing. But once the Torah was given, so now we have mitzvos, now we have responsibilities to live up to, now we have a mission in life. And if we are enslaved and we're not able to fulfill those mitzvos, we're deprived of the ability to live up to our mission, so then that becomes a very terrible thing. Before we had any type of purposeful life, so all we cared about was staying alive, so death was the worst thing, imprisonment is better than death. But now that we have mitzvos, now that we have a Matan Torah, we have a charge in life, so that's more important that we should be able to fulfill that. That's a part of what it means to be alive. To be alive and to not be able to fulfill the mitzvos is missing something very fundamental. And it's an important point for today and for tomorrow, because it highlights the fact that as Jews, our freedom is very important to us. We believe very much in freedom and liberty. And ultimately, because we believe that's what allows us to live up to our potential, that a lack of freedom means that we are not given the ability to do what we feel we really need to do in life to fulfill our purpose, that we have external constraints stopping us from actualizing our potential. And we seek out an existence where we have no such constraints, where we live in a land that is free, that gives us liberty, that gives us the ability to perform our mitzvos, to perform our responsibilities, and to maximize the potential that has been given to us to become Ovdei Hashem and to become full people in the absolute sense. And to that, within that context, we are profoundly grateful to live in a nation that provides us with those opportunities, that is built on the principle of religious freedom, of personal freedom, of liberty, and we greatly cherish that value, and we're profoundly grateful for that opportunity, with a recognition that that's not freedom for the sake of being free, freedom for the sake of being absolved from all responsibility, but freedom in the sense that that gives us the capacity to become fuller human beings and to become more complete and perfect Ovdei Hashem. And of course, this is very much the theme of Chanukah, as we've been discussing this whole week. What exactly is it that we are celebrating in terms of the Nes? What exactly is the core theme of Chanukah? And we discussed how the miracle seems to, if it focuses on the Pach HaShemen, seems to be something which was less absolutely necessary as far as our surviving, or even as far as our mitzvos are concerned, except to the extent that it reflects our desire to live at the highest level of religious performance, to maximize what we can accomplish. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu therefore meeting us in kind and saying, if that's what you want, so that's what I will bestow upon you. And that's our tremendous bracha, that Chanukah reflects our rebellion against the Hellenizing forces that say we're not going to let you live up to your spiritual potential, and our pushing very hard in the opposite direction and saying we're going to exert a tremendous effort to make sure that we can, and God recognizing that effort and responding in kind. So this is the theme of Chanukah, and the fact that Chanukah and Thanksgiving this year, and the only time in many, many lifetimes apparently, will converge the way that they do, is an opportunity to reflect on the fact that we are so grateful to live in a nation that gives us this opportunity, that gives us this freedom, and that freedom is a mechayev, that freedom is a obligating factor that requires of us to respond appropriately, both in terms of we have to recognize that gift, that's what Chanukah also tells us, we have to have the spiritual sensitivity that even Paro has to recognize when that benefit is there and to respond and step up to the moment and to be grateful for having it, to express that gratitude as Chanukah teaches us, and also to express it in an even more profound way by making sure that it is valued, making sure that it is maximized, and to not let the opportunities slip away with the passage of time or with the intoxicating nature of freedom when perceived as being absolved of all responsibilities, and rather with a recognition that true freedom and true liberty means the ability to be true to oneself without any external impediments. And for that, we are profoundly grateful to the United States of America and to God. Just add one more point, somewhat a halachic point, that's in Yana Yoma for today, for right now, but also kind of flows out of our whole discussion. So we've been talking this week about Simcha and Chanukah, what exactly is the character of Simcha and Chanukah. So as you know, so our practice is not to say Tachlin on Chanukah. And it's a little bit of a question why that is. And that there's actually 2 days in Shulchan Aruch about it. That the question is it about the following point, that the Vilna Gaon understands that the reason that we don't say Tachlin on Chanukah is because it's prohibited in Hesped and Tainis, and therefore we don't say Tachlin, which is associated with those types of negativities. While the Shibboleth Halakhah says a little bit differently, he says it's because of the Chiyuv of Halal on Chanukah that we've been talking about this week, and is that Yom HaShah Hashem Nagila V'Nismacha Bo, that since we are purely happy on a day of Halal, so it's not a day of Tachmin. So this could have an afkamina, as the Sefer Pesach HaMoed points out, that a question of whether or not we should say Tachmin on Erev Chanukah. It says in Shulchan Aruch that certain days you don't say Tachlin, you don't say Tachlin on the day before, the Mincha before. And Chanukah, it's a machlokes, it's 2 days, whether or not the staying away from Tachlin on Chanukah, is that only on the days of Chanukah itself, or does it extend to the period of Mincha immediately before, which of course is the Zman that we are in right now. So it's a question directly in the Geya, Halacha of this month, Yonah D'Yoma of right now, is there a Chi of Tachlin at Mincha, is there and you're not to say Tachlin at Mincha. So the question might be totally, as the Sefer Pesach Omoid points out, on what the real reason is that you don't say Tachlin on Chanukah. That if it's like the Vilna Gaon says, that it's because the prohibition of Hesped and Tainis, so we find that that's something that extends to the day before, at least the afternoon before the day in question, so that already starts now. So then the abstention from Tachnin should apply as well. While if it's a function of Halal, so then Halal is only said on the days of Chanukah itself, and therefore only during that time would there be an abstention from Tachnin. So that theoretically could be relevant to us right now, but in another sense it's not really relevant this year, because as we know, today is actually Friday. So since today is Friday, so you don't say Tachlin Friday afternoon, so I guess it's not relevant for that purposes. But theoretically, the question of Erev Chanukah at this time is perhaps totally on those points. So it's just to kind of end off our discussion of Simcha and Chanukah with one point of Halacha L'maisa that's Nogea right now. Okay, I wish everyone a wonderful afternoon, and weather appropriate behavior, a Freilich and Chanukah, a Freilich and Thanksgiving, and may the themes enrich each other, and may we continue to grow from both mutual experiences. I wish you have a wonderful Shabbos.